Hannah.
And I'm Colleen.
And we combined have lived in Iraq for
11 years.
We get a lot of questions about life in Iraq. And we decided that the best way to address those questions is to do a little podcast. So we're going to answer some questions that are really common.
The ones we get asked all the time.
Yeah, because apparently it's a weird thing to live in Iraq. Who knew?
Yeah, strange.
So today we're going to be talking about Nowruz.
Yay!
And probably you're going, what the heck is Nowruz? Because unless you're either Kurdish or Iranian, you probably have no idea.
It's not an American holiday.
It is not. So this is the follow-up to our American holiday podcast. When we said we were going to talk about Nowruz, this is that time.
Yeah.
So let me tell you a little bit about Nowruz. It does kind of have its roots, its history in Iran, but the Kurds are kind of a mix of Iranian culture and their own culture.
Yeah, it's the Medo-Persian thing.
Yeah, and so they've kind of taken this like spring fire festival and kind of made it their own thing. Probably the roots are really in Zoroastrian religion. But it's just kind of like a spring festival or like a spring party.
It's New Year's. It's a New Year's celebration.
And they really go all out for it.
All out.
Yeah. So the story that I heard about why the Kurds celebrate this is that there was this evil king who was taking all of their children and, like, brutally murdering them.
And maybe eating them.
Maybe eating them, maybe bathing in their blood. It was very gruesome, you know.
Yeah.
Probably to make him seem like a real bad guy. And there was this one blacksmith who had a beautiful daughter, and the king stole the beautiful daughter, and the blacksmith was like, I'm not going to stand for this anymore. I'm going to go get my daughter back, and I'm going to free the other children, too. And so the villagers were like, well, you do that. And if you succeed, like, send us a signal so we know, and we'll, like, kill all of his soldiers here so that it will be, like, a complete coup and, you know, we will have won.
Woohoo!
But nobody really thought he was going to do it because blacksmith versus king. Who do you think would win?
And, like, he's super powerful and, like, mean. Right.
So in all good stories, though, the blacksmith wins, and his signal to the town people is that on the hill that the castle is on, he builds this big fire. And the townspeople see it, and they know that he has won. He has killed the king. And so they kill all the soldiers, and the kids come back to the town, and everyone is happy.
And they light a fire on their hilltop, too, to let the next village over know. And it just spreads.
Kind of like in Lord of the Rings.
Yeah. But in Kurdistan.
And so because of that, they celebrate it every year. That's the short story.
The short story. But fires definitely play a part in the celebration, as well as, like, traveling out onto the hillsides. And
oh, for sure.
It's very, very celebratory.
Probably the biggest part of it is that, like, everybody gets new clothes. Kind of like for Easter when we were kids.
Yeah.
But the clothes are real different.
Well, I mean, because they dress up in their traditional clothing, but in a really super dressy way that has kind of expanded along with modern technology to include a lot of glitter and sequins, for the women, at least. And these clothes are called Jilly Kurdi.
Which just means, like, fancy Kurdish
clothes. Kurdish clothes. It just means Kurdish
just
clothes.
Just Kurdish clothes?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. And, like, everybody has, like, the women especially have, like, the super, like, sparkly, but everybody gets like a new set of
Kurdish clothes every year.
Yeah, and you have to like plan way in advance,
and you can't really, like, you can buy some like pre-made, but for the most part nobody buys the pre-made ones except for tourists. And so everyone goes out to the markets, and all of the fabric sellers have just stacks and stacks and stacks of clothing and
cloth.
And so you go and you pick out, like, the under, the underdress part of it and the overdress part of it and then like the jacket or vest part of it, depending on which part of Kurdistan you're living in.
Right.
And the under part is usually a pair of balloony, like Aladdin pants.
Like harem pants.
Like harem pants. And then there's a basic sleeveless or sleeved tunic that goes over it, and it's kind of long. And this is made out of some sort of really shiny fabric, like a lamé, often.
Oh, see, mine is just, like, plain cotton.
Oh, really?
The tunic part is just plain cotton.
But that's far more breathable than what they wore in our area.
Yeah, that's not, like, the fancy part. That's, like, the underclothes.
Well, and see,
in Duhok,
in Suli, the second layer is often a netting or thin. And so the under, so you have to spend a lot of time looking at, oh, I like this color for the under. What does it look like when I lay this other piece over it?
Gotcha.
And how do these colors interplay? And so then the overdress is usually a long dress. Mm-hmm. Not a lot of fitting to it. But it's either a netting or a kind of a thinner, sheerer fabric with either elaborate beading on it in some sort of pattern or sequins, or sometimes just like sparkly thread woven in, usually in bright colors.
Do they have the like elastic waist that like gathers it in?
Not almost usually.
Like an entire waist. Okay, no. That's very Badini.
Yeah, more in the Duhoki area that does that. But the women in Suli often will kind of cinch it up with a bright gold belt.
Mm-hmm.
The younger you are, the more around your hips it gets. And then in the Suli area, you also wore a vest that was usually made out of some fabric that was entirely sequins.
Nice.
In Duhok, I know you guys have more of a cloak, and it's usually velvety.
They do like a long, like overcoat almost. So that the long sleeves of your dress kind of come out the end of it, and you fold them back over the sleeves of your outer jacket. And like mine is a really nice velvet material.
Mm-hmm.
Other people get something that's a little more sheer or something that's a little more shiny. I went for like mellow, which is not Kurdish.
But they do, even the Suli ones, that overdress, it's not just a dress. You're right. It has these long, almost medieval style, like trailing sleeves. And I don't know, do the Duhok women, do they tie them in a knot and throw them over their back?
Yep.
Or have someone come around behind and tie them in a knot?
Yep.
And so like you can kind of use your arms. Like it's not super tight, but there are definitely limitations put on you by the fact that your sleeves are tied in a knot behind your back.
Yeah. And again, usually they would like fold them over their sleeves and then tie them so their forearms were free.
Mostly free.
So, you know, like if they have to cook or make tea or whatever.
Going on the trip to buy the fabric to make the Jilay Kurdi is one of the most hysterically fun experiences. My first trip, I think I went with some other teachers and, you know, of course you run into a student or you know somebody who knows somebody who has a fabric store, and you wind your way into the bowels of the bazaar, and they take the fabric and they lay it out across the floor, and you're like, ah, it's gonna get dirty! But, you know, you gotta lay it out and see what it all looks like, and then lay this one over top of it and see what this one looks like paired with that one, and if you make your vest out of this, and if you line it with that, and they want you to get the brightest, most sparkly thing possible.
Yep.
Yeah.
I actually had four of my female students take me to get mine made, or to pick out fabric, well, and to get it made. And the men at the shops were very much like, oh, you gotta go bright, you gotta go sparkly, like, it's gotta be, like, crazy. And my students were like, no, like, that's not what's actually fashionable amongst, like, the younger generation, so we want you to be cool like us.
So mine
ended up being much more, it's really dark. I mean, it's sparkly, but it's kind of a more subtle sparkly.
There you go.
It's more like starlight, less like
sunshine.
Concert.
Like, my first one, I managed to get them to tone it down a little bit, and I went with a kind of a darker maroon red. Mm-hmm. And I really liked that one. I actually wore that one out.
Yeah.
My second one, I loved, it was brown. And I had to fight to get them to sell me the brown. Because they're like, you're young, you shouldn't wear brown. Brown is for the old women. And I was like, I like the brown. Mm-hmm. I'm not going to, like, stick out on the hillside this way.
Right.
And then the one I have most recently was actually a gift made for me.
Nice.
From one of my students. And it is lime green. Like, the brightest lime green color.
Like a pickle.
Like a pickle. I'm a shiny pickle. And I do wear it. But it also actually is wearing out now. Yeah. And I don't know where to go to get one made in Nashville.
I'm sure somebody
makes them, though.
So that's the women. The men's outfit is very, very different.
Yeah.
And obviously we have less experience with mm-hmm. that. But I've been told that it's more comfortable.
Oh, I've worn one. It's really? Super comfortable. Yeah.
So the men have these kind of like
it was baggy... for a costume.
Okay. All right. They have these like baggy pants that mm-hmm. are gathered at the ankle mm-hmm. and gathered at the waist.
It's just got ties in the inside, so it doesn't have like any elastic or anything. You just
cinch it up. You can wear it as tighter as loose as you want.
You can wear it as tight or as loose as you want.
And they have big pockets.
And huge
right?
pockets.
And the top varies more so.
Mm-hmm.
And the men's stuff tends to be in like gray or black or tan.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Maybe some dark browns.
Yeah, and in my area, like the wealthier you were, the more stripes you had in mm-hmm. your Julie Curdy. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what that was about.
Yeah.
But not like pinstripe, like big bold stripes.
Yeah.
But that again was kind of like an older generation tradition.
And so then they wear kind of like a plain white shirt.
Button collared shirt
kind of underneath it, and then like either a vest or a jacket that matches the pants,
mm-hmm.
and then you end up with this wide strip of fabric that's usually some sort of pattern or stripe like or
a floral,
you know, that they wrap around their midsection.
It looks so cool. I can't figure out how they do it.
And it kind of holds everything together.
Yeah.
With
the shirts tucked into the pants.
Yeah. The little boys, though, their vest always gets me because the ones that are super traditional have this, like, fake little set of legs that pop off the shoulders because it's supposed to imitate, like, a goatskin vest thing. And so they end up with these weird little points off the shoulders that always made me laugh.
Yeah. And there's some variety in, like, mm-hmm. some of the guys have more, like, a military-looking top with like the little loops on the shoulders and pockets on the front.
Yeah.
And then some of them are just more like a really deep V jacket almost mm-hmm. that's tucked mm-hmm. in. And then, yeah, just like a vest.
Yeah.
So I feel like there's some variety in that. And again, that's like generational and mm-hmm. like tribal or like.
And more recently, even wearing both for men and women, wearing camouflage, like yeah, clothing to true. Match the Peshmerga has been really popular as a
yeah.
kind of a nationalistic
I did see
statement.
A girl who, her Julie Curdy was all Kurdish flag material.
Yes.
It was very, like, surprising
green
to
and
my
yellow.
Eyes. Like, it hurt my eyes a little bit. Like, mm-hmm. way to go, be very nationalistic, do what you want, but I need sunglasses to look at you. Like, it's just real bright. So that's a big part of it. The mm-hmm. other big part of Nowruz is picnics.
Yeah.
And not traditional, like...
This is not your American picnic.
American picnic where you take a blanket and a basket of sandwiches and laze about out in the grass
yeah.
for an hour or two and then go home.
No. This is a production.
Oh, yeah. Like, party bus... Three or four family.
All the moms.
Like three or four families.
Spend like the whole day before cooking vats of food
mm-hmm.
to take with you on the picnic and gathering up. Like you would think, like if an American family packed this much food, you would think they were going to be camping for several days.
Right. Right. And it can't, in their defense, it can feel like several days when you go on these picnics.
Yeah.
Because usually you, like, get all packed up and leave, you know, you say you're going to leave at 8, you really leave at 10, and then you drive out into the countryside. It could be an hour. The farthest I think I've gone, we drove 5 hours out to where we were going to have a picnic.
And you have to, like, stop at several places along the way to see if it's the right place.
Get out and look around.
Find the spot with enough other people in it already and a tree.
Right, but not too many people.
And some water.
Some water near the, you know, grassy, mountainous.
Something with a good view.
Yeah. I mean, I have been to picnics that are just like, ah, look, an empty field. We're going to have a picnic here. But those were people who weren't really trying. The best ones are when, like, someone has somewhere in mind and you all get on this great big party bus and they drive you out, like, down these dirt roads where you feel like maybe they're just going to leave me here and see if I can survive. But those are always the best places because it's, like, beautiful and no one else is out there. And, yeah, you go with those people. Those people who make you suspicious that maybe they're trying to get rid of you. Those are the best picnics.
You play loud music and wave your handkerchief or your Jilly Curdy sleeve out the window. And you stand and dance as you careen around the road at 60 miles an hour.
Minimum. Yeah, 60 minimum. But yeah, it can be like all day. It's not just like, let's go for lunch. It's like, let's go, let's get set up. We're going to sit around and eat some fruit, chat.
Build a fire,
wander around a little bit. Then maybe we'll have some vegetables. Maybe that's when the biryani comes out. And then you lounge and drink some orange soda and water and... Then someone puts meat over the fire. Then the dolma comes out. And you eat that. And it's just like this long, luxurious...
But also interspersed with dancing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, of course.
Because you bring your whole, like, stereo system. Or, you know, if maybe you're not quite a big enough party for that, you just play it loudly out of the car.
Car stereos. Yep. Yeah, and everybody dances, and it's surprisingly tricky.
Really?
Okay, so Bahedini dancing is different than Suli.
That's true.
There Suli are more moving parts. Not
difficult for someone who has an inkling of rhythm.
Yes, it is very rhythmic and it's very repetitive.
Yeah,
which is good. Which means that you learn it. Fairly quickly.
As long as you don't think too hard about it, you'll be fine.
Yes. Yeah, that really is the key. Like, you just join the group and you go.
And you just feel what the people next to you are doing and you just follow.
You follow.
You gotta throw out your American independence and conform to the group.
And you never stand at the beginning and you never stand at the end because those people are important and they, like, keep the pace going.
Yeah.
So you get right in the middle.
And if you get too close to one end, you pop out and you pop back in somewhere else.
Yeah. And no one really cares.
It's the thing to do.
It is. And they can dance and dance and dance. And
hours.
Dance.
Especially the students.
Whew. Yeah. They have a lot of energy.
They do.
But it's everything from the, like, forwards, backwards thing that is popular in Suli. Do they do the pinky holding?
They don't. They do the whole hand.
Whole hand, shoulder to shoulder.
Shoulder to shoulder, smushed in.
That's the best way to learn.
Yeah.
Because, like, your whole body is moving in rhythm.
And you get the people who have... I had never learned how to have rhythm with my shoulders. And now I've learned how to have rhythm with my shoulders.
Yes. Yeah. See, that's... De Hook is different. They do pinkies.
The pinkies. It's a and little so harder.
The pinkies are, like, going kind of, like, up and down at a slightly different rhythm than the feet are going.
Yeah.
And you're not, like, jammed in together, so you can't just be carried along. Like, you could trip and mess everyone up.
Yeah. It's a little easier in Suli.
I will say that I do prefer the De Hook version because I don't feel as claustrophobic. I feel a lot more like, okay, I can, like, look around me and, like, I not breathing in the air that someone else just breathed out. Like, that's, I'm a fan of that.
Yeah.
But yeah. I do like the squished in stuff when I know people well. I appreciate it more. Because it's like, yeah, we're here and we're dancing. It's all we're going to do for the next 4 hours. But dancing's not the only thing. I mean, it's definitely eating and dancing are the primary things.
Yes. Eat, dance, eat, dance, eat, dance.
Yes. Probably the biggest thing that Nowruz is known for is fire jumping.
Yeah.
Which I actually have never seen anyone do.
Yeah. I mean, it wasn't common. Like, it wasn't common when we went out on picnics with our students or things like that, because most of the parents are like, or the teachers are like, we don't want to get into trouble with that sort of thing.
Right.
Like, it's traditional, but people do that in the villages with their families. Like,
right.
We don't really do that.
Right. If you're going to fall into a fire, do it with your mom right there.
Exactly. Yeah. And I know, like, sometimes they would put fires up on top of tall things, and mm-hmm. I think that was so that people wouldn't jump over them.
Oh, smart.
But yeah, one of the main Nowruz events that we would go to would be they'd close off the whole main street the night before Nowruz and wander up and down it. And sometimes there they had fires, big fires, that people mm-hmm. were jumping over. And it seems a little terrifying to me.
Yeah.
But it's, like, totally normal. Like, it's part of what they do.
Right.
Even smaller children. And then sometimes they catch on fire.
Well, the less dangerous event that I saw much more often is kites.
Hmm.
I fly kites. Again, not necessarily super common, but I've definitely been on several picnics where the kids have kites, and then, you know, the dads help them get the kites in the air, and then the dads kind of fly the kites.
Uh-huh.
While the kids run around and play soccer or whatever. So it's like the man's gateway to kite flying.
Is through their children.
Through their children.
Excellent.
And that's kind of fun. Like, to me, I was always like, look at the cute Kurdish men flying kites. It's so cute. I mean, I never said that because...
No, of course not.
You don't want to make them feel uncomfortable. But I did go and ask, like, hey, can I fly a kite? And they were like, no. This is not for women.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't say women. They just said it was not for me. So I don't know if they didn't trust me as an American to know how to fly a kite.
That's true.
Which is entirely possible.
Yeah.
Or if they were just like, no, this is a man thing.
Like, or I'm having too much fun. I don't want to give it up.
Yeah. There was also some, like, mild hiking that usually happened. Because,
mm-hmm.
mm-hmm. you know, you're out in the countryside or in the mountains.
Yeah.
And you want to go kind of explore. Which always impressed me because the women would always wear high heel shoes.
Yeah, and they can hike in them.
And hike. And I was always like, how do you not die?
But they're, or, like, break an ankle. Just the shoes we always wear. Unless we're barefoot. Like, we're just going to hike in the shoes we have. Yeah.
Like, I wore sandals.
You like usually wore my Chacos.
Yeah, Chacos. Every single time. Because I was like, I know I'm going to be scrambling around. And I don't want to hate myself.
Yeah. I don't really want to break my ankle while out on a picnic.
Yeah. And they were always like, why are you wearing those shoes?
Those are ugly shoes.
Like,
You're supposed to wear sparkly shoes.
No thanks.
Hmm.
And again, I think some of the younger women would bring, like, a change of clothes and change into, like, pants and a t-shirt and a jacket and hike in that. And then come back and change back into their
chili curdy. Back into the chili curdy.
For the dancing and the eating. But because this is something that everyone does, it means... And it's usually all on the same day. Like, the official day of Nowruz is March.
The 21st of March.
21st, that's right.
There's 21 points on the star of the Kurdish flag because of Nowruz.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm.
I've heard lots of explanations for that, but never the Nowruz one.
Really? Yeah. I think that's the only one I've ever heard.
Hmm. But because it's a national public government holiday, everybody gets the day off.
I don't know, most people get, like, the whole week off.
Or, like, 3 weeks off sometimes.
Or 3 weeks off.
But especially on Nowruz Day. Yeah. Everyone is leaving the city and going picnicking.
And I will say, the other bonus to that is that March is the most beautiful month in Kurdistan.
Yes.
It is no longer cold and wet and rainy and miserable, and it's not the miserable hot of the summer. It, like, March and usually, like, into April a little bit, maybe, depending on the year, it looks like something out of an Irish calendar.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's green and lush and stunning.
I feel like whenever I show people pictures from, like, Nowruz picnics, they're like, this is in Iraq? Like, this is Kurdistan? It looks like Ireland or the Highlands of Scotland or something. And I'm like, no, that's Iraq. I mean, it's for, like, 6 weeks.
But it looks like this.
It is beautiful.
But it's beautiful for those 6 weeks.
And so everyone wants to get out into it. Mm-hmm. And usually the outgoing is not so bad, except in Duhok, the night before Nowruz, everyone wants to go out to this one particular mountain that looks down over to Duhok to watch the fireworks get set off.
Hmm.
And my Duhok team and I only attempted it 1 year, and it was a terrible experience. We sat in traffic for probably at least 4 hours trying to get up the side of this mountain.
Oh, gosh.
And a van full of, let's see, there were like 7 adults and 3 kids crammed into this van. We did have air conditioning.
There you go.
Not
all vans have air conditioning.
Yeah. But we got up to the top of the mountain and, like, had almost burned the transmission out of the van, because stick shift up a mountain road is not good. And we were just all so grumpy and so fed up with each other and, like, fed up with... It was one of those moments traffic. Where you hate everything.
Yeah.
And so it was like, why do all these people have to come up on this mountain? You can't see anything anyway. And so we just, like, turned around and went back down. We didn't even stay for the fireworks. We were like, we're just going to go home and have a
be
fire.
Done.
Have a fire on our roof and cook hot dogs and be done.
Yeah. American picnic style.
Yeah. Which we did. And we were all much happier.
Yeah. Yeah, you're right. We didn't usually have too much trouble getting out of the city for picnics, and that time I guess you managed to miss the return traffic. Yes. Jam rush,
right? Because we left right away.
Because you left right away. But that was one of the things I always remembered, was coming back after a picnic, you know, and the road, which is normally, you know, a 2-lane road, 1 lane going each direction, would be like 4 lanes of people going all the same direction. Mm-hmm. Into the city. And yet it's still, like, stop-and-go traffic.
Mm-hmm.
And you just wait. And you just... One of my favorite... I don't know if favorite's the right word. One of my most distinct memories was one of the times we were up on this one mountain. And I remember thinking, oh, it's starting to get dark. We're probably going to leave soon. And we were near this road. And, like, before we talked anything about leaving, and I realized later that there was no plan for leaving in a... short time. Like, it was planned to be there till like midnight.
Mm-hmm.
But like, all of a sudden the road near us that goes into the city that we would have to take to get back into the city was full of cars.
Yikes.
Like, both lanes full of cars. And we just sat there and, like, you could watch the row of taillights wind down the mountainside.
Yikes.
And, like, for hours. Like, if we had left then, it would have taken us an hour to go what would normally have taken us 10 minutes.
So how long were you there?
We were there till almost midnight.
Good gravy.
It was fun. We had a good time.
Yeah, yeah. You weren't sitting in traffic.
We weren't sitting in traffic. We were mostly sitting and drinking tea.
Nice. Which is super
important.
Is
the most important thing.
We did leave that out.
That's true.
Tea drinking is very important. And I will say, Kurdish tea cooked over an open fire after, like, a really long day of being outside.
Especially if it's a little cold.
Mm-hmm. That's, like, the best thing I've ever had in my life.
It's amazing.
Unqualified. That's the best thing I've had in my life. I remember once in particular, it was really kind of rainy, and me and a couple other teachers have been working on making tea, and everyone else was like, we're ready to leave. And they all got in the bus. and the four or five of us sat out there until our tea was done, and we drank our tea slowly. I think we actually maybe even made like a second pot of tea. And like everyone else, there were like 20 people waiting for us in the bus, and we were just like, no, we're gonna have our tea. And it was the most Kurdish I think I almost ever felt, because I was just like sitting out here on this mountainside. Everyone around me is speaking Kurdish, and I'm drinking my tea, and I'm inconveniencing a bunch of people, and I don't even care. I'm having a good time.
And it's amazing. Like, you talk about how that feels so Kurdish. Like, I've been to the Kurdish celebrations here in Nashville, because there are so many Kurds here. They have a Kurdish celebration here.
Which is, it's huge.
It's massive. Down in the park. It's a Sunday before or after Nowruz, and depending on the weather, it can get pushed, changed at the last minute. But, like, I remember one of the years I was sitting there with some of my friends, Kurdish friends, and, like, I closed my eyes for a moment, and I felt like I was back in Kurdistan because the smell of the chai tea, you know, and the fire and the meat roasting over the fire and the sound of all the Kurdish voices and the Kurdish music in the background. I was like, oh my gosh, if I can't see the trees,
right, which is the big giveaway.
Our big giveaway in Nashville. Like, I would totally be back in Kurdistan at this moment.
Yeah. I think that picnic is probably the biggest Kurdish picnic I've ever been to.
Yeah.
Like, it was impressively huge.
There are thousands of people that come every year.
We only saw like, a small fraction of it. Mm-hmm. But, like, to give you, dear listener, an idea of how big a deal this is, the mayor and the congressman for our district showed up and gave speeches at this picnic.
Yeah.
Like, it's a big deal. There are a lot... I mean, that's thousands and thousands of voters sitting in this field, and they're just happy that you're there to acknowledge them as Kurds and, like, join in this with them. And I was like, this is such a mix of, like, Kurdish hospitality and Kurdish political, like, know-how. I was just like, oh, the Kurds are so smart. And so, like, genuinely hospitable. Like, it's not purely, like, a political, like...
No.
We're gonna get together and change the world for Kurds to make it better. It's also, like, this is part of our culture, and we want you to be part of it. And we're so glad that you, weird white American woman, dressed in Julie Kurdi, are here with us.
And they can get really excited about... Westerners dressing in their traditional clothing. Like, to them, it's a huge honor that you would do that. Like, even in Kurdistan, I remember one time, again, on Salem Street, walking up and down the street with all the Kurds, and, like, people, like, would bring their child to me and ask if I would take a picture with their child. Like, you know, I'm like the Easter Bunny or something. And there was one place where me and some of my teammates stood for over 45 minutes as people rotated out to get their picture taken with the Americans wearing the Kurdish clothes. Yep. But here, I think it's actually been almost more fun because I went to the grocery store once before I was visiting and going to the Nowruz party in Julie Kurdi, and had several people stop me and comment and ask questions. And
nice. Yeah, it's awesome.
It's an adventure.
It is.
It's a chance to release your inner Barbie. That's what yes. I was always told. Like, you gotta let go of your American inhibitions and your adultness and just
go for it.
Go for it. Go for the sparkles.
Go for the sparkles. It's true. I think the sparkliest jewelry I own, I wear with my Julie Kurdi.
Oh, yeah.
For sure.
Mm-hmm. And like, the sparkliest makeup I wear is all specifically what I wear with Julie Kurdi.
Yeah. We hope that you have a wonderful Nowruz. If you can find some Kurds somewhere near you, tell them happy Nowruz, and they will, like, invite you to their house, and you will have tea and cookies, and they'll probably make you dolma, and it will be amazing, and they'll just be so grateful that you know about their holiday.
Yeah.
And if you don't have any Kurds, come to Nashville sometime around the 21st. There will be a giant picnic it's usually in the same place, but sometimes it's it's not always on the same day.
Yeah, it changes.
But yeah, if you ever get the chance, go on a picnic with a Kurd and you will have a life-changing experience.
Yes.
For sure.
You can find us at Servant Group International on Facebook or Instagram or on our website at servantgroup.org.
Yeah, and if you have a question that we haven't answered yet, send us an email or Facebook message. We'd love to hear from you. Thanks for listening. What is it? The beacon of Minas Tirith has been lit. Gondor calls for aid.